Good morning and welcome again to the World Aquatic Health Conference. And this particular session is sponsored by the American Physical Therapy Association's Aquatic Section. It is my thrill and honor to introduce Dr. Tanaka. He is currently an associate professor and director of the Cardiovascular Aging Research Laboratory at the University of Texas at Austin. He received a BA in Physical Education, Martial Arts, at the International Martial Arts University in Japan, an MS degree in bioenergetics at Ball State under the auspices of Dr. David Castile, and a PhD in applied physiology from the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. He has also completed a postdoctoral training in cardiovascular physiology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He's published over 170 research articles in journals such as Circulation and the Journal of Physiology. And I would just like to add that today his talk is on, do swimmers who train just as hard, as long, and as frequent as other athletes in land-based exercise modes have the same favorable risk profiles for coronary heart disease as other athletes, and do swimming training interventions reduce the risk factor of CHD? Please join me in welcoming Dr. Tanaka.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Before I get in, I'd like to thank Dr. Bruce Becker for inviting me over. As you can see, my affiliation here, my primary research interest in cardiovascular aging. So I give a lot of talk in this area. But for swimming, even though I have done a lot of research in this area, I don't have many opportunity to present. So I'm very excited to share this information with you. So if you have any questions, just feel free to stop me anytime. Then we can stop and talk about it. Okay, so here's an overview of my presentation today so that you have some idea of where I'm going during my presentation. So I'm going to give you, the first, an overview of what the swimming from the scientist standpoint. And then I'm going to focus on the cardiovascular health. And what I have decided to do here is to focus on the cardiovascular risk factor that most of you are familiar with. So I took out all the emerging and exotic risk factors, and I'm going to focus on very familiar topic to most of you here. Well, I don't have to preach to this crowd, but swimming is not a new sport at all. Because when you look at ancient drawings coming from Greece and Egypt, you can see the picture of men swimming everywhere. Yeah? And when you look at just Olympic swimming, the swimming has changed a lot over 100 years. And if you look at this, this is the Olympic Games 100 years ago, and compared with the London Olympics here. Just look at the physique of elite Olympic athletes from Australia 100 years ago. And if you compare them now with current Australian squad, you can see the swimming has changed a lot over 100 years. But one thing that hasn't changed in the swimming is this. Okay? Swimming remains one of the most popular sports. And this came from a Census Bureau. And swimming, as you can see here, is the most popular sport and second only to walking. Okay? Well, the swimming is particularly popular down in South. And here in Austin, where I live, you have a number of swimming pools available for people to enjoy swimming all over the city. And when you think about biggest beneficiary of swimming exercise, you think about older people or elderly. And this is a U.S. Census Bureau data again. What this showed is that the elderly population, defined as 65 years and over, are moving from a cold north location to a warm south locations, where the swimming pool is more abundant. So potentially, the swimming is going to be a great exercise for those people who are moving to the south. Okay, so how does swimming fall into in terms of recommended exercise mode? Well, the best way to look at this is to look at guidelines for exercise prescriptions that's recommended by American College of Sports Medicine. This is the biggest sports medicine organization in the world that I belong to. And if you look at their recommended mode of exercise description, it's stated as follows. Any activity that uses large muscle groups that can be maintained for a prolonged period and is rhythmic and aerobic in nature. If you think about what kind of exercise falls into this, well, you can think of a lot. Walking, for sure, cycling, sure, cross-country skiing, rowing. Well, the swimming is undoubtedly and clearly is one of them. But is there any difference between swimming and other exercise mode? Well, there are a lot. The first, obviously, swimming is performed in the water. So the exercise medium is totally different. And because of this, you are surrounded by hydrostatic pressures, and exercise is performed not in upright positions, but it's either in the prone or supine positions. So your cardiovascular response is totally different. Okay? On the top of that, you are putting a high thermal conductivity and a facial immersion in the water on the top of it. So it will change your cardiovascular response. Okay? And another thing that is totally different from other land-based exercises is that you are going to rely primarily on the upper body strength rather than lower body strength. So there are a lot of differences in here. So the question is there any advantage of performing swimming for the health promotion purposes? Well, there are a lot. The one is that swimming is non-weight-bearing activities and buoyancy effect in the water. Because of this, you're going to have a reduced incidence of orthopedic injuries. So this is actual data comparing swimmers to other endurance athletes, like triathletes, runners, and cyclists. As you can see, the injury incidence per year is the lowest among swimmers. Okay? So if you are obese people, when they engage in the walking and jogging programs, they're going to have a lot of joint problems. But when they engage in the swimming, you can actually minimize the orthopedic injury. Another thing, okay, if you're obese, and you are exercising in the heat in the summer, especially in Texas, well, you're going to get overheated. You're going to get into heat exhaustion. But in the swimming, because of this increased thermal conductivity, you got reduced incidence of heat exhaustion. So if you think about who's going to benefit from exercise, these obese people, elderly people, the swimming fit perfectly for this purpose. Okay, the biggest problem in swimming. There are not much research in this area. If you take a snapshot of how much and what kind of research has been done in the area of human cardiovascular disease, here you see walking, running, cycling, and swimming. As you can see, the swimming research is not much right here. It is actually the lowest, lower than the cycling research. So we do need to put a lot more effort on the swimming research here. Okay? But if you actually try to look in to PubMed search, wait a minute. We have tons of swimming research in there. It's because you see a lot of swimming research in animals. Okay? Because when you do animal research in exercise studies, you can choose either one of these two, swimming or treadmill or running. Okay? But the treadmill running in animals like this, you have a treadmill that rats run on. Okay? Those treadmills, turns out, it's very expensive because you can't buy those in Sears. You know? And another thing is, because we have an electric shock on the bottom, graduate student has to watch this all the time, and the rats get stuck on the bottom here, and then it takes a lot of man effort to do that. But what about swimming? Well, the swimming, what you have to do is put the rats in the bucket. So it doesn't cost you anything. It's really easy to do, right? But the one problem, okay? One problem is that you can see the rats swimming right here. But if you carefully look at how the rats do, rats usually goes on the bottom of the pool and just look around. And then when they get really ischemic or grasp for oxygen, just goes up and then goes back down. So because of that, what we usually do is to put the number of rats on the bucket. So it is really easy, but it's not different. It's so different from human swimming. Okay, so you cannot extrapolate those research to human swimming. Okay, so let me talk to you a little bit about why we don't have swimming research in general. The one is that it's very tough to make a physiological measurement because it's in the water. Okay? Another thing, if you want to have a cardiovascular benefit, you need to increase your heart rate high enough. But many sedentary people do not have swimming skills enough to do so. Okay? And clinically speaking, because you're exercising in the water, you have diving reflex, cold pressure response, and cardiac arrhythmia that many physicians are concerned about that shoots up your blood pressure. You have an abnormality in your cardiac rhythm and stuff like that. And on the top of that, if those cardiac patients are exercising on a treadmill, we can put ECG electrode and monitor how you are doing. But in the swimming, we can't do that. So you have a limited monitoring of those patients, which causes another problem here. Okay, before we move on, because in this conference, everybody is talking about their personal experience. So let me tell you my personal experience in the swimming. Okay, I was born and grew up in a swimming crazy nation of Japan. And look at this. I mean, even in the States, you cannot see those excitement and the enjoyment of people just looking at swimming here. Okay? Back then, Japan was really strong in the Olympics. And you know that in the London Olympics, U.S. got most of the medals, right? Nobody has to deny that. Do you know who got the second in the medal count? You think, oh, yeah, maybe Australia, France. No. It's Japan. You didn't know this because you got those Michael Phelps, Ryan Lochte, Missy Franklin, right? That's your guys are gazing on it. But if you carefully look at it, what? The Japanese guys are right there on the corner. That's why you didn't notice. So Japan did great. And I can tell you, the one of the reasons swimming is so popular in Japan is because swimming is a required PE curriculum in the most elementary schools and many middle schools. It is kind of in the karate, you change your belt from white to yellow, yellow to red, and so on and so forth. In Japan, you do the same thing in the swimming. If you're really novice, you get white hat, and you advance it to yellow and red, and so on and so forth. And even in the public level, swimming is very popular in Japan. Okay, this is a Tokyo Samaran, and you can see how crowded those swimming pools are. And I can tell you there is a slogan at the Tokyo Samaran because this swimming pool is very close to my parents' home, so I usually take my kids there. So this is a slogan that you see. Welcome to breathtaking Tokyo Samaran, where you can wash away the pressure and stress of the overcrowded city and relax with your friends and soothing enjoyment of sunfan splashing. So this, it is really funny if you try to compare this with this. But I can tell you, though, it's not really like that. In the summer, it's really packed. But as I say, I take my kids to the same place. You can see the slide here. It is the same place. Okay? So if you go to off-season, you can see there's nobody. Because U.S. kids have so long of a summer vacation. Water is warmed, actually. Yeah, it's heated. Yeah. It's a very nice pool. You should go there. One thing I can tell you, though, is that if you have tattoos, any kind of tattoos on your bodies, you're going to be refused for admission or you get kicked out because tattoos in Japan is a symbolic figure for the Japanese mafia, so you cannot go in there. Okay, let me talk about today's main topic here, which is cardiovascular health. And let me give you the research methodologies that we use in our lab. We use two different approaches. One is a cross-sectional approach, and another one is interventional approach. So we first performed cross-sectional approach comparing swimmers with sedentary people or the other endurance athletes, because this is a very easy study to do. Okay? Then if we see any differences, we're going to move on to interventional studies. So what we do is to recruit untrained subjects and put them in the swimming training programs or the control group, and see we're going to observe the changes in the risk factors that we are interested in. All right? So the first thing I'm going to talk about is here, is body weight and body fat. I'm sure most of you are interested in knowing this. Do you guys know the Japanese artist named Hokusai? Some of you say yes, some of you don't. But if I show you the picture, you know. He's very well known for drawing those Fuji Mountain pictures. But it turns out he left a lot of cartoons as well. Okay? One of the cartoons that he left is called Fat People and Skinny People. Okay? And if you look at the fat people here, you can see the people are very sedentary and laying around. But if you look at skinny people, they're very active and doing something. So you really don't have to see the data. Just observe people, and you can see the association between physical activity and body fat levels. So what does a swimmer's body fat look like? Well, any age you are looking at, adolescents to college swimmers to middle-aged swimmers, the swimmers do have higher body fat compared with runners. Okay? This is a very consistent finding. And this trend becomes more exaggerated when you look at distance swimmers. These are the ultra-endurance swimmers that swim across English channels. And if I tell you that these are the elite endurance athletes, and a lot of public, general public say, what? Well, of course, those channel swimming is done in frigid English channel. So it is a good advantage if you have a lot of fat, because you can minimize the reduction in the core temperature. Okay? If you are thin, you can see core temperature drop substantially. So there is benefit for having fat. Yet, if you compare that to distance runners who are really skinny, it is very a contrast between these two populations here. And one study that we did is we are wondering if you focus on older athletes, specifically postmenopausal women, and if we match the swimmers and runners for the confounding variables. So we compare the swimmers and runners, ages, it's the same, and hormone replacement use, and the years after postmenopausal, and the years of training, and exercise training duration, the performance levels. Swimmers and runners are well matched. And then when you look at the body fat percentage, you can see the swimmers, older swimmers, do have higher body fat compared with runners. And if you look at the waist circumference, swimmers do have a lot higher than runners. Okay? Well, what about intervention studies? Let me first give you, if you perform a walking exercise intervention, if you perform walking exercise for about 16 weeks, you are going to reduce your body weight and reduce fat mass. Okay, long-term effect of exercise is very controversial, but a short-term exercise training program, you see this kind of changes fairly commonly. Okay? What about swimming training? Well, we did this using an obese, hypertensive subject populations, and as you can see here, the body weight in swimming training group, their body weight didn't really change. And body fat percentage didn't really change either. Okay? Well, let's look at another study. Probably this is the best controlled studies to look at the effect of swimming on the body weight and body fat. So they compared walking and cycling and swimming. And those people who engaged in the walking and cycling programs, you can see the body weight in the yellow was reduced significantly. When you look at a body fat percentage in the red, they were able to reduce their body fat. But when you look at the swimming was totally ineffective in reducing body weight and body fat. So the million-dollar question is, why the swimming is so ineffective in lowering weight and lowering fat. Well, when you talk about that, you can talk about calorie balance or energy balance. It turns out if you compare the energy expenditure of swimmers during exercise compared with those during running, it is the same. So swimmers and runners, they're burning about the same calories during exercise. Okay? So if that's the case, maybe we should focus on this resting metabolic rate, because this occupies the largest amount of energy expenditure on a daily basis. And as you know, the metabolic rate goes down from young sedentary people to older sedentary. Okay? As you get old, your metabolic rate goes down. Probably I don't have to tell you. Probably everybody knows here. But when you look at young and older runners, the reduction in the metabolic rate is actually minimized. And when you compare the resting metabolic rate of older runners and older swimmers, they are identical. So the energy expenditure side of equations, this is not really the reason. It turns out the swimming has some differential effect on this energy intake side. So let me show you the data here. So this data was published from scientists at the University of Florida. Okay? What they did, they observed what kind of food and how much food they eat after they get done exercising. Okay? So this is a resting control, and this is exercising conditions. You can see, after you get done swimming, the caloric intake jumped up from 600 to about 900 kilos. That's a lot. And it turns out most of the extra calories that you consume after swimming came from fat. You can see 27 to 35. For some reason, the swimming appears to stimulate appetite. For those of you who've done a triathlon like I do, you know this. If you get done running, all you want to eat is like orange peel. But after you get done swimming, you just want to eat a pizza, whole pizza. Right? So you know this. But one thing that's really interesting, okay, they conducted a neutral water trial. So instead of using cold water, they used a neutral water temperature. When you do that, the increase in the caloric intake as well as increase in the fat intake was abolished. What does that mean? Well, it does have implications for the swimming pool management. If you have a swimming pool and you're pushing for the weight loss, okay, or the fat loss purposes, well, it would be better off if you heat up the pool and try to increase the temperature so that you don't need to stimulate a participant's appetite that way. Okay? All right, so here's a brief summary here. Swimmers tend to have a greater body fat compared with other endurance athletes, and swimming training does not seem to reduce body mass or body fat, and the reason is swimming appears to increase appetite. Okay? Now, so the research question that we are addressing is this, the primary. Will these swimmers who are known to be fat have favorable risk factors despite higher body fat percentage? Because their body fat and the cardiovascular risk factors are closely linked to each other. Okay? So, and as I say, I just established that swimmers have higher body fat. Well, swimmers do have risk factors that's more favorable. Well, that's a question. Okay. So first thing I'm going to focus on is this, aerobic fitness. And the gold standard, okay, for aerobic fitness is called maximum oxygen consumption, or VO2 max. Probably a lot of you are familiar with this term because it's in the name of the drinks, name of the gyms, and everybody's abusing this term in these days. But what we usually do is participants actually put on those masks and we collect expired gases and analyze for oxygen consumptions and carbon dioxide productions. And that's how we determine it. And you can do that on a treadmill, bikes, cross-country skiing, and we can even do that on a horse. And we can do that in swimming as well. And as I mentioned to you, it is tough to do measurement in swimming because you have to carry those horses, and you usually put the bag on the end of it. You have to change it around. It takes a lot of work to do this. The easiest way would be that if you have a swimming flume, then you can actually collect expired air this way. It's a lot easier, even though it's really expensive to do so. OK? Okay, but the bottom line is you can do that during swimming as well. Okay, so I just showed you the maximum oxygen consumption is a gold A standard for aerobic fitness, but we also use it for endurance potential as well. If you look at a cyclist populations going from sedentary to Miguel Indurain or Lance Armstrong area, you can see those graded response that the higher the potential for endurance sports, the greater the maximum oxygen consumption. But the reason why we're interested in this is because aerobic fitness or maximum oxygen consumption is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. That's why we are interested in this. Well, you can see this is a data came from a Cooper Clinic, and I just put this cartoon here because this cartoon sucks. Because you can see these are American-made compared with a Japanese-made one that I just showed you. You know, you can actually debate on the quality of the cars and radio and TVs. But when it comes to cartoon, nobody can beat Japanese, actually. Okay, what I want you to focus on is this, okay, on the lower bottom here. So this graph, let me walk you through. So you have lean subject here and normal and obese subject, okay? And as you move from lean to normal to obese, you can see the relative risk of cardiovascular disease will go up, okay? So the fatter you have and more risks you have. But look at a fit population. If we look at the fit populations, even if you are obese, the risk of cardiovascular disease is quite low. So one interpretation of this is that, well, even if you are fat, as long as you are fit, you'll be fine in terms of cardiovascular disease. And if you apply that to swimming populations, could swimmers fall into this category? Okay? The one tricky thing about swimming is this. Okay? If you engage in a swimming training programs, and of course you are going to increase your VO2 max when you are tested during swimming in the water. But when you put those swimmers on a treadmill and evaluate them VO2 max, you can see that swimmers don't have any difference in the VO2 max compared to sedentary population. And we also did in postmenopausal women, we measured VO2 max on the treadmill. You see sedentary population, swimmers and runners. Okay, even though the swimmers are fit in the pool, okay, those fitness doesn't show up really well on the treadmill exercise. The reason for that is this, the fancy term called specificity of training. So the idea is if you want to excel in one sport, your training method have to mimic as close as possible to that exercise. Okay? So if you perform exercise training in swimming, you can see and you're tested in the swimming pool, you see increase in VO2 max. But if you test those swimmers on the treadmill, the training effect doesn't really show up well. Okay? So that's the problem. Well, so what I'm trying to tell you is that those data on the aerobic fitness and the cardiovascular risks are done on the treadmill because most of you is going to engage in activities on the land. You don't spend 24 hours in the pool anyway. So idea is this. It is not known if the improvement in aerobic fitness obtained in the swimming pool is associated with reduced cardiovascular risks. So we really don't know that yet. Okay, let me focus on the blood pressure. Okay, the blood pressure, as you know, probably I don't have to explain. It's measured by putting a blood pressure cuff. Why are we concerned about that? Well, it's associated with stroke and aortic dissection and other diseases. And that's blood pressure, especially systolic blood pressure, is known to increase as you get old. This is an extremely common disease. About over 75% of elderly have a blood pressure. I'm sure if I look around, majority of you probably have high blood pressure too, even though you may be hiding on that. But anyway, so So what does the exercise do on the blood pressure? Well, land-based exercise at least, like walking, jogging, swimming, is effective in reducing blood pressure. So this is one example. Okay, your initial blood pressure is 153, and after the training, your blood pressure went down to 142. You can also see the similar reduction in the diastolic blood pressure as well. Okay, what about swimming? Well, one tricky thing is this. If you look at a swimmer's blood pressure and compare it with other athletes, track and field, basketball, you can see swimmers do have higher blood pressure compared with other athletes. If you look at the different studies, swimmers 130 and the runners 120 and sedentary even 120. So swimmers do have higher blood pressure. It is not clear if this is due to overtraining of swimmers because swimmers are notorious for overtraining. And also they have a bigger biceps. So if you use smaller cuffs to measure blood pressure, your blood pressure shoots up, okay, independent of true your blood pressure. Okay. So you have to, in order to address that, you have to perform intervention studies. Okay? So one thing you can do is to recruit hypertensive populations, and after 3 months of swimming training, and you can see how those systolic and diastolic pressure change. And as you can see here, okay, swimming training reduced systolic blood pressure as well as diastolic blood pressure. So the swimming was effective in terms of reducing blood pressure. But this study that I just mentioned to you has a lot of problems because we have a smaller number of subjects, and experimental design-wise, it was not strong. So we recently completed this study here, and we measured blood pressure in a swimming training group with a bigger number of subjects. Okay? Another thing we did, swimming is really tricky because if you're getting used to your physicians or nurses, your blood pressure go down over time. Okay? So if you're getting used to investigators throughout swimming training programs, that would account for reduction in the blood pressure. So what we did is we made an attention control group. That is, those group of a subject came into the lab at the same frequency as swimming training programs, and they performed the stretching and relaxation exercise. And when they did, the systolic blood pressure stays constant. But when you look at the swimming training program, they're very effective in reducing the blood pressure. Okay? So the bottom line here is that swimming training reduces blood pressure in a patient with hypertension. Okay, now let's move on to blood cholesterol. I am sure you're familiar with this as well, so I don't have to explain too much. Okay, so if you go to a physician's office, and if you have high cholesterol, and they tell you, oh, you got to do exercise because exercise reduces your cholesterol. That's not true. So you need to wipe it out. Okay, so this is a review paper coming from Dr. Dustin from University of South Carolina. And as you can see here, if you perform regular exercise, the total cholesterol or LDL or bad cholesterol do not change with exercise programs. So does exercise do anything? Well, it does. What the exercise effect is to increase this HDL cholesterol. This is a good cholesterol. Okay? So exercise is still beneficial for the cholesterol profile because it increases HDL cholesterol. It also reduces a blood lipid called triglyceride. Okay? So that's the effect of exercise here. It's not reduction in the total cholesterol and LDL. So what does swimming do? Well, once again, if you look at the cross-sectional studies and looking at swimmers' HDL or good cholesterol, okay, their values are not different from sedentary populations. And if you look at the runners, again, runners have a significantly higher good cholesterol, HDL cholesterol. And then if you compare the older population, because the data that I showed you in a young subject, so if you look at the beneficiary of exercise, you have to focus on the older populations. And when you look at older populations of HDL cholesterol, again, compared with sedentary populations, swimmers do not have a higher HDL concentration, even though runners had highest HDL. Okay? But triglyceride-wise, the swimmers did have a significantly lower blood lipid concentration compared with sedentary, even though their bodies are still higher than runners. Okay? And if you look at, this is only one risk factor that I'm going to talk about that may not be familiar to you. It's a plasma fibrinogen concentration. This molecule is involved in blood clotting. So it is closely linked with plaque formation in atherosclerosis. And when you look at plasma fibrinogen concentrations, again, the swimmers' values fall right between sedentary populations and runners. Okay? Well, what about intervention studies? Well, if you put them in the swimming training programs, interesting thing is HDL cholesterol, again, the swimming didn't elevate HDL concentrations. But what they did is to reduce triglyceride and the total cholesterol and LDL concentration. So swimming exercise was effective in lowering cholesterol, unlike land-based exercise. And this study is an Australian study that's really interesting. So they followed those participants over a year. Okay? And one group engaged in walking, and another group engaged in swimming. Okay? For those people who engaged in swimming exercise, was able to minimize the age-related increase in the cholesterol, as well as the increase in the bad cholesterol or LDL concentration. So swimming, unlike land-based exercise, was effective in cholesterol concentration maintenance. So again, the swimming training does not seem to increase HDL cholesterol, but unlike land-based exercise, swimming training appears to reduce other factors that are associated with atherogenesis. Okay, let's move down on the list to plasma glucose and plasma insulin concentration. Okay. So for that, what we are concerned about is diabetes. Diabetes is a serious problem that affects a lot of organs throughout your body. And if you look at the prevalence and incidence of cardiovascular disease, for example, it went down over time. But incidence of diabetes is skyrocketed because the entire nation is getting fatter and fatter. And obesity is closely linked with diabetes. Okay, so that's a problem. When you look at the diabetes, okay, diabetes is often preceded by something called insulin resistant. That is, your tissue is becoming resistant to the influence of insulin. Okay, so because of that, your pancreas is trying to put up a lot more insulin, and your insulin levels goes up. So when you look at a swimmer's insulin concentrations, they are significantly lower than sedentary populations, even though their values are higher than runners. Okay? You can also calculate a more sophisticated methodology called the insulin sensitivity index. That is, the swimmer's values, okay, their tissues are more sensitive to a stimuli of insulin. You can see the significant difference here. Well, this is another. Same study, the Australian study that I mentioned to you. Okay? The insulin concentrations. After 1 year of swimming training program, the participants were able to reduce insulin concentrations. So when it comes to carbohydrate metabolism, regular swimming is closely associated with better insulin sensitivity. So in theory, it should be associated with reduced incidence of diabetes. Now, let's focus on this psychological mood state. I mean, psychological mood state is, you know, underemphasized area in terms of cardiovascular health, but it's very important. And when you engage in a swimming training programs, it does improve your mood. There's no question about that. You can see the hunger scores goes down after swimming training, and the fatigue levels will go down. And at the same time, your vigor score will increase. Okay? And another study, so this is a very interesting study. So they measured enjoyment scale rating in walking, cycling, and swimming. And turns out, the people who participated in the swimming had the greatest enjoyment rating. Oops. So what does that mean? Well, this is important because over 50% of people who start exercise programs quit within 6 months. So exercise dropout is a substantial problem. But if people enjoy those activities, okay, it would lead to better adherence to the programs. So this is a very important findings here. And if I really think the swimming is enjoyable, I don't have to go anywhere but look at the pamphlet of your conference. And you can see this big old smile. And there's no question that she's enjoying swimming, right? I hope I don't get busted for copyright infringement here. Okay, so regular exercise produces a greater enjoyment and better mood state. And these psychological effects of swimming appears to be greater than other exercise modes. Okay, let's focus on the last one here. Cardiovascular disease mortality and risks. Well, when you look at the literature concerning exercise and cardiovascular disease mortality and risks, most of the research are done in either in walking and cycling and those land-based exercise. Okay? And one of the studies that was recently published came from a Cooper Clinic. And what they found, okay, is that when you look at the all-cause mortality of swimmers, they're substantially lower than sedentary populations. That's a great message. Okay? But one thing that everybody is really puzzling to think is this. The swimmers had substantially lower mortality rate compared with runners. Why are we really concerned about that? Well, because if you look at other epidemiological studies, they're not showing that. So here's a study coming from Harvard, okay, showing the effect of running, jogging, rowing, racquetball, and swimming on the coronary heart disease risks. And when you look at these epidemiological studies, okay, running and jogging, of course, so the value of one means there's no effect. The lower the values, the better effect in terms of reducing risks. And you can see the running had the lowest values of 0.47. What about swimming? Well, swimming didn't demonstrate any risk-reducing effect. Okay, so it's really tricky because when you try to make sense out of it, you only have two epidemiological studies to compare. So again, unlike land-based exercise mode, it is not clear if swimming is associated with reduced risks of cardiovascular disease mortality. Well, so what's the overall message here? Well, you know, in these days, newer journals are coming up like crazy. So it is really tough for scientists like me to keep up with the literature. And if you look at the professor's desk, and I'm sure you think, oh, yeah, I had a professor like that. But it is natural because it's tough to keep up with the literature. But when it comes to swimming, my desk is empty because I can easily keep up with those literature. So we do need more research because we have more questions than we can address. Okay? Oh, and I'm very grateful that Dr. Bruce Becker and the National Swimming Pool Foundation, they decided to fund a research study that deals with swimming exercise interventions in patients with arthritis. You know, I was in an airplane coming here, and if you look at the in-flight magazines, you see this ad coming from Arthritis Foundation. And it says, my weapon in the fight against arthritis. And you see a guy swimming. Interesting thing is, you see several studies looking at effect of aquatic exercise on arthritis. But when you try to find studies on the swimming exercise effect on arthritis, believe it or not, there's none. Yet, you see this ads right here. So I'm very excited doing this research here. And It should be coming up. Results, I'm hoping to present the results in probably 2 years from now. So, and if you're interested in this area that I just presented, most of the research that I presented is in this review papers I presented 2 years ago. So you can actually look it up and study yourself. And thank you very much.
Would you just like to call, entertain any questions for Dr. Tanaka?
Go ahead. So the question is there a way to account for the genetics in terms of studying those effects? The quick and easy answer is no. So see, the genetics is really tricky situation because everybody is interested in genetics and everybody talks about it. But when you try to account for the gene polymorphism and other stuff, it doesn't really explain a significant portion of the exercise response. And we are still puzzled in terms of how we can account for that. I mean, I do collect those gene data too, but every time I do that, I failed miserably, even though I'm spending tons of money to generate the data. So I'm really backing off those areas. Possible, yes. Yeah, go ahead. So the question is there any difference in sprint swimmers and endurance swimmers? So if we look at the elite athletes in terms of physiques, height, body fat, there are studies on that. But when you try to look at those cardiovascular health, they don't really differentiate between the two. But the swimming is kind of tricky because when you look at a sprint runners, okay, they're very lazy and they don't really train that much, right? But if we look at the sprinters in the swimming, they train like crazy, right? If you think about swimming, most of swimming event doesn't last more than 2 minutes, yet endurance swimmers to sprint swimmers, they train like crazy. They swim like crazy. So in terms of the specificity of training, they're totally violating those principles, you know. Yeah. Yeah, well, one thing I can tell you about Steve Blair's study coming from Cooper Clinic. It's tricky. Cooper Clinic is a prestigious institution. Of course, Harvard is a prestigious institution. Who's going to believe that? But anyway, both studies suffer from a small sample size. For example, the Cooper Clinic study, you know how many swimmers died in that study? 11. And how many runners died in that study? Over 1,000. So the swimmers' data is really solid, but the swimmers' data is not. Because if you had a 13 dead instead of 11, the conclusion and the results are totally different in that study. And the Harvard study is also suffer from a small sample size, even though their sample size is about 112 or somewhere in the neighborhood. So the sample size is bigger, yet, again, they still suffer from smaller sample size, so you really can't. Either one of those studies, you can't really trust it until they increase the sample size. Maybe we should make it off the record so that I don't get attacked by Steve Blair.
You would agree with that.
Okay, that's good.
If zero had died, would we say that it's useless?
Yeah. No? That's true. Anybody else? Yes. Yeah, so the question is, United States Masters Swimming, a lot of older swimmers in the database. Couldn't we do the studies like that? Well, there is actually a runner of studies which is very interesting. There's a magazine called Runner's World, and they actually send out those questionnaires to the readers of Runner's World, and they are supposed to send in blood cholesterol and blood pressure profiles and stuff like that. It is a great way to do the research on the runners. What about swimmers? Well, the Joe Steger from Indiana University has done a little bit studies like that. I've seen his data, but in the abstract format, but I haven't seen him presenting as a paper anywhere. So there is an attempt to tap into that. Yeah, even though that's actually a great idea. I mean, I'd like to pursue that, but, you know.
You need to know what they're doing when they're not swimming in that study.
Yeah, yeah. That's very important. Yeah, I think they do that too, because you have to isolate the effect of swimming from other exercise. Yes, absolutely. Oh, we do.
You have a captive audience.
We do. That's how I was able to recruit a master's swimmers. Yeah. So actually, Texas is actually a good place to study swimming. Yes. Go ahead.
You said the exercise dropout rate is about 50% within 6 months. Has that ever been done comparatively between different sports, including swimming, running?
So the question is, exercise adherence rate or dropout rate, is there any comparative studies comparing, say, swimming to running and stuff like that? The straight answer is no. But there is a studies on effect of exercise intensity as well as home-based, as well as supervised exercise program. So they're trying to isolate the effect like that. So the bottom line is, if you do home-based exercise as opposed to supervised exercise, adherence is so much better. And if you compare the low-intensity exercise to high-intensity exercise, low-intensity exercise is better in terms of adherence. But if you try to compare swimming and running, there's no systemic studies like that. Even though the studies done by Gwinnett that I showed you, they did report a dropout rate, and swimming was slightly better than other exercise modes. Well, you can come to UT Austin and do the study. those kind of studies are very tough to do. Okay? But I mentioned to you that swimming stimulates appetite, right? But that appears to be biological. Why is that? Because if you study rats, okay, you can put rats on a treadmill, and you can put rats in the swimming programs. Rats eat more chow, okay, when they get done swimming compared with running. So somehow it's a biological in us that stimulate appetite from swimming.
Yeah,
core temperature went down a lot greater in the cold water. So there is association between reduction in the core temperature and the stimulation of appetite. Yeah.
Folks, if we could just thank Dr. Tanaka, and we're getting ready for the next session. Thank you.